Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us there as well. We're always interested in hearing back from you. Today, we are talking to Rachel Loudon. She's the author, most recently, of Cuisine and Empire. We're going to talk to her about food, about Thanksgiving, and about the way what we can learn about the ways of the world through the ways that we cook and eat. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here, Nick.
So we're talking to you in Mexico City, but in the United States, Thanksgiving is only a couple of days away in the United States. You've written about how this particular holiday was designed as a kind of deliberate repudiation of aristocratic European-style meals, especially those that French people in the 19th century kind of put on. Does it still function this way, American Thanksgiving? And of course, you lived in America for a long time, but you're originally of English extraction. So, is Thanksgiving still a repudiation of kind of stuffy upper crust meals?
I think the consciousness of that's been lost nowadays, partly thanks to Julia Child's efforts to democratize a kind of high-end French cuisine. French cuisine has a high status in the United States. But even so, nobody suggests adding truffles to your turkey. Mm. Just this morning, I saw something flashed up on my screen, laughing at the great French cook Escoffier, who published a book on Thanksgiving in 1911 and suggested a whole series of French dishes. And the author said, well, he just didn't get Thanksgiving. So I think there is still this sense that Thanksgiving is not a fussy, highly technical meal to prepare.
So it's more of, kind of what's on the farm, and obviously it functions on some level as an enactment of what it means to be American at any given point in time. But what, where does the turkey come from? Because my understanding is that at the original Thanksgiving, they were probably eating lobster and shellfish more than turkeys. Is that right or wrong?
The exact makeup of the Thanksgiving meal has shifted, and it didn't really take absolutely canonical form until Norman Rockwell painted that famous picture of grandmother plenty for all Thanksgiving in World War II. That's when turkey, in the form we now know it, becomes absolutely central to Thanksgiving.
I have like a million questions about the foods. I'm asking an English person living in Mexico City to tell me about American food. But turkey is, it gets used a lot in cold cuts and delicatessen meats more than it, people aren't typically preparing a turkey a week the way that we might do with a chicken or parts of a chicken. Were turkeys ever a kind of go-to meat, or do they remain this kind of holiday thing? Because you definitely trot them out literally or figuratively at Thanksgiving and Christmas. But other than that, you're not really cooking them very often.
No, I think there was a time when they would have been commoner as part of the whole game pantheon of America, along with venison and anything else that you could shoot, squirrel or raccoon. But now, of course, we're not eating wild turkeys, we're eating cultivated turkeys, and they come, or farmed turkeys, they come in a very awkward size. And despite the manufacturer's attempts to sell turkey breasts or turkey thighs or turkey tails, people still, as you say, don't want something that size, and they haven't really adapted to turkey parts.
You, in your 2013 book, Cuisine and Empire, you open it by stating that you take seriously the fact that we are the animals that cook. And this is something that we've been doing for, I guess, 5,000 years or so as human beings. Talk a little bit about that cooking, and I have enough of an undergraduate memory of, I guess it was Levi Strauss talking about the raw and the cooked. What is so important about cooking, and are we really the only species that that actually cooks its food?
Yes, I mean, certain animals do things. They smash shells to get the meat out from inside. But the full range of cooking techniques are specific to humans and probably go back, I think, quite considerably longer than 5,000 years. I think of cooking as having four components, not just fire, that's one of them, but also cutting and grinding and pounding, mechanical operations that turn that turkey into sizes you can cope with, fermenting, which gives us bread and beer and cheese and so many other things we like, and chemical reactions as well, marinating things, adding alkalis or clay to food. So humans have a vast range of techniques that they apply to raw materials to change them into something that they put in their mouths and then digest and become assimilated to the human body. This is probably, I think, our most fundamental and most extensive set of technologies. The people who want to talk about language may disagree with me, but it does all kinds of amazing things for us and our ability to interact with the world around us.
Yeah, in Cuisine and Empire, you talk about the discovery of, I guess, what are considered staple foods, things like millet and maize and rice and, you know, other grains. And there's so many interesting connections there. You write that cities, states, and armies appeared only in regions of grain cuisines, and that a feast following a sacrifice to the gods was the emblematic meal everywhere. And it's, I guess it's not fully clear if that's because that's just what humans do, that we develop that in parallel or not. But talk a little bit about what is that connection between having a grain culture, which includes a lot of the kind of operations that you described that humans perform on raw food or raw substance. But why, what is the connection between grain and having a city, having a state, and having an army?
Absolutely essential, I think. Mm-hmm. Grains are one of the last foods humans master. They are really very, very difficult. Also, they don't come along until fairly late at the end of the Ice Age, but they're very difficult because they are tiny, they're fiddly, they're very hard, and it takes a great deal of skill to turn them into food. Now, the same things that make them difficult to turn into food also actually turn out to be the things that make them so valuable. Because they're the food for new plants, they're very nutritious. So you get almost all your nutrients if you just eat grain. Not all, but most. Mm-hmm. Also, because they are hard, they store well, and because they are dry and small, they are relatively easy to transport. If you compare the fact that people can live on 2 pounds of grain a day, whereas if they want to use roots like potatoes, they have to use 15 pounds a day because the potatoes are full of water and therefore much heavier. It just imagine when you're dealing with moving food into cities or moving food with human or animal transport, it's much easier to do it with grains than with roots, which are the main competitors.
And then it's, you want the armies to protect the grains or the food supplies or to take somebody else's, I assume.
Yes. I mean, once you've got this wonderful storable source, and also, you know, obviously roots are not very storable because they mm-hmm. go bad quickly. They rot because they're wet. Once you've got this storable food, then people quickly gather that if they can control that storage, they can control other people. And you quickly move to hierarchical societies with chiefs and then kings with cities. And what the early kings in their palaces do, I mean, in some ways you can think of their palaces as the first big food processing units in the world, because they collect in the grain, They turn it into something edible and they use it to feed their armies and their bureaucrats. And that keeps their social status going.
And I suppose even if it's not in the kind of contemporary parlance of property rights or of tradable property rights and whatnot, in order to grow grain, you need secure borders. People have to know this is I can go on this property or I can't. And I'm thinking back to stories about Robin Hood and whatnot of, you know, of the crown saying, okay, well, you can hunt here or you can gather grain here, but you're not allowed to do this. So it, I guess food production really does imply all sorts of boundaries and eventually property rights as well.
I think so. And I think also this is where sacrifice comes in. One of the great puzzles, of course, is why large numbers of people put up with being ruled by small numbers of people. And this is not a complete answer, but one thing that rulers do is to say to people, well, look, I'm the intermediary between you and the supernatural powers, the gods. And if I offer sacrifices to the gods, because I can offer the biggest, best sacrifice of grains and animals, then the gods will give you plentiful harvests, lots of children, and success in battle. And as long as those conditions prevail, populations tended to stay fairly quiescent. If harvests failed, then rulers were always in very deep trouble.
Is there a kind of axiomatic rule of, like, you know, three bad harvests in a row and your head's on a pike, or it's more varied than that, I assume, in kind of ancient history of how many years you can starve, you know, your people can starve before they give you the heave-ho?
Well, the people don't want to leave it too long, because once you get really weak, then you can't do the heave-ho. Most ancient societies have kind of rules of thumb about how much they need to store. They would like to store 5 years' worth, almost impossible. If you can manage 2 or 3, that's really good. And they also, of course, have rules of thumb about what you do if it runs out, what you eat first and last. And the last thing is other human beings.
And, I mean, your book talks about the different kind of civilizations and cuisines, I guess, that grow up. But, I mean, this is all coming out of evolution, right? So there's variation, but there's also a lot of commonality between this, you know, between the practices and customs that everybody, every human society everywhere does, right?
I think there's a lot of commonality. And I have kicked around, is this due simply to, you know, people responding to fairly common sets of conditions, namely that only grains can really support cities? Mm-hmm. Or is it due to the enormous amount of contact there was between different societies from very early on? We have this picture of, you know, one nation or one region, one cuisine. You know, there's French and there's English and so on and so forth. But in fact, what you find throughout history is that the ways people eat are highly mobile. As people, you know, it is the most useful set of techniques. So people are very quick to pick up useful new cuisines, and they spread around the world.
Do you have a favorite grain, by the way, or is this like having children, where they're all special to you in their own way, or is there something that you like more than the others?
Well, I grew up with wheat. I guess I'd have to say, you know, bread and pasta.
Are you mad about that? I mean, you know, wheat gets into a lot of trouble these days with the whole gluten, you know, gluten intolerance and the kind of mainstreaming of celiac disease. Do you feel like wheat is getting a bad rap?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it's a pity, because it's still the case that the three big grains are, you know, the most important, you know, most of our calories for the world still come from them. If we try to go some kind of paleo route and, you know, say we're not going to eat grains, I mean, there's nothing else that yields so well per acre in terms of calories. So we're going to have a huge, huge problem on our hands.
How did people, and I realize this is literally the subject of many books and large sections of your intellectual work, but how the hell did rice ever become so widespread? Because it seems to me, even when I buy it in a plastic bag that I can just put in a microwave, it's so complicated. It seems to be so labor intensive, so resource intensive, so land intensive. It just blows my mind. Why is it partly because it obviously stores really well, but that it takes so many people to produce that it keeps people busy. They can't kill their leaders, or maybe that's just the American in me talking.
Oh my goodness. I mean, there is, before you get these highly labor-intensive irrigated rice systems, there is dry land rice, which is much more like wheat. So when you start, you don't have this enormous labor of people, up to their knees in water planting each little rice plant. That comes later. Probably not, until quite late in history, actually. And there's a whole set of theories about that, whether that held back the development of Asia, which was kind of Cold War model for lots of people after World War II. That's been pretty much debunked now, but it hinges on all kinds of, mildly technical arguments about rice agriculture that maybe we should leave for another time.
One of the things that, yeah, I mean, you touched on here and has always been fascinating to me is how quickly, kind of, you were saying techniques, but other foodstuffs and whatnot move from one place to another. And we're always quick to typify entire countries or nationalities or ethnic groups, societies, as being defined by what they eat. You talk about the French fry, which my French friends, of course, tell me are actually from Belgium. There was a writer in the 20s who talked about the French fry as I apologize to all speakers and listeners of French when I say you it was the Parisian plot par excellence in the 20s. But then in the 1960s in the United States, when McDonald's realized that they could use frozen potatoes and create a very flavorful and a very cheap and easy to do French fry, French fries are now at least as associated with the United States. I mean, a cheeseburger, a milkshake, and French fries. Talk a little bit about this, this kind of global food trotting and cuisine trotting, and I guess first, why do we want to see food as exemplary of a particular time and place, and then why does it move around so quickly?
The first one, the answer to why we identify people by food is I think that we are all deeply what I call dietary determinists, namely that we are what we eat. And therefore, what you eat comes to seem to define you. This has good sides and bad sides. We all know about how, racial epithets are often food related, frogs, trouts, beaners for Mexicans. It can also be a sign of pride that this is, really my national dish and don't touch it. Why do they move around so much? I think for the reason I already mentioned that. We've rather forgotten it because we have such abundance that we're not always looking for, another leg up with food. In fact, we hardly know how to cope with the abundance we've got. But in the past, all societies were always constantly on the outlook for new plants and new techniques for turning plants into food. It was a dangerous thing to do because food is intrinsically dangerous. You put it in your body and it turns into you. That's a very scary kind of thing when you think about it. Any new food is very scary, but at the same time, there's this tremendous incentive to take advantage of new foods.
Obviously, it's encoded in the title of your book, Cuisine and Empire, but food is often used as a proxy. And I guess we use this in common language all the time. You shove something down somebody's throat, whatnot. Obviously, I'm thinking of the British occupation at various points of Ireland, expropriating food from Ireland to feed to its English subjects and whatnot. McDonald's, to stick with the French fry, which I guess in many ways the French fry, possibly even more than the hamburger, defines McDonald's triumph. But McDonald's is often seen in the way that Coca-Cola used to be, and I suspect that there were British companies in the 19th century that were seen as, the avant-garde or the advance force or the soft cultural power of cultural imperialism. You talk about in your work about McDonald's in particular as different. And McDonald's gets pilloried all the time. And you've written that diners around the world, diners adapt McDonald's to their own purposes, which are quite different from those in its American homeland. Talk about some of the different ways that McDonald's diners and I guess also franchisees change things to adapt to their own cultures. And what does that say about the kind of human ability to speak through kind of mass-produced objects, actually, to speak individually or culturally through something that is made, by somebody very far away?
Well, let me begin with a little anecdote that always sums up some of this for me. I taught at the University of Hawaii for a number of years, and my students went off on a field trip to Washington, D.C. to, see the great American capital, which was, they're a very long way away from this in Hawaii. And when they came back, I said to them, well, what most impressed you in Washington, D.C.? And they said, there wasn't any rice in McDonald's. And when McDonald's went to Hawaii in the 1970s, which is still within the United States, they had to modify their menu there to include rice because Hawaii is a rice-eating society and they didn't want French fries, they wanted rice. So there are two things that franchisees have done and diners. One is to modify the menu, vegetarian food in India or, eggs in Uruguay or what have you. The other is to change the experience. In Mexico City, for example, where there aren't a great number of parks and where there is a danger of kidnapping, middle-class mothers, because it is a middle-class thing, it's too expensive for the poor, will take their children to McDonald's because there's a playground, not because they want to eat McDonald's. In Hong Kong, a student of mine told me it was a venue for children's birthday parties. And another student told me that in Vietnam, it was a place where a woman could eat by herself without being thought to be a prostitute.
That's amazing. And I'm glad to know that we re-imported the McDonald Play Place model back into the United States. I know that my kids, whenever their mother or I needed a break, one of us would go to McDonald's and kind of stick them in the ballroom for as many hours as we could be there until they kicked us out, and that we were actually enacting something that might have been pioneered in Mexico or another country. Do you you don't seem to have in your work the kind of hang-ups about commerce and about the mixing of cultures or the blurring of boundaries? Where does that come from? Because you talk about the philosophy of cuisine. In a number of interviews I've read with you, you have a kind of alternative path to what an academic career and to a research career. Where are you coming from in terms of a kind of ideological push to talk about history from below, but also that, commerce is worth investigating, not simply castigating?
Oh, my goodness, my life history. Well, I was originally a historian and philosopher of science and technology. So I was on the one hand, very interested in how ideas shape people's behavior, but at the same time, I was very interested in how technologies, which are shaped by ideas, are so important. And then about in the mid-1990s, my husband and I decided to quit academia and go freelance. We'd loved our time there, but we thought it was time for a change. And so we did. And I'd always been interested in food. I wanted a big project, so I picked up A History of Food as a big project. As to my political take on food, I find it very hard to label myself clearly as coming from one or hewing to one particular political perspective. You know, yes, I do think trade, industry, technology, all those things that get labeled as big, I don't see how we can run the present world without them. On the other hand, yes, I don't want to condescend to ordinary people. I don't think they are just passive receptors of big does to them.
So it's, you know, and it's certainly true that McDonald's, again, I guess I have it on the brain today, spends a huge amount of money advertising on TV and in magazines and sending coupons out. And that almost certainly has some impact on consumer behavior, but it's people don't eat McDonald's simply because they're programmed to like crap or because a giant corporation can kind of dictate everything that you want or desire in your life.
I that's what my opinion would be. And, you know, the idea, we've sort of taken up the idea that various, say, food industries are juggernauts. You know, in the 90s, McDonald's looked unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And now McDonald's is not expanding at anything like the same rate. And I'm sure its corporate executives are wondering desperately how to, you know, maintain the momentum. Right. Then it was Walmart that looked unstoppable, and now it doesn't anymore because of Amazon. And then it was Monsanto that looked unstoppable, and I'm sure that will stop too.
And, well, you know, to bring it back to specifically to food, too, Chipotle in the United States was unstoppable. And then, part of their appeal, and I guess they had some early funding connections with McDonald's, but was the fact that it was all locally produced and organic produce. And then they ran into some problems with the food preparation and the food safety, and now they're still reeling to recover from that. What is your take on discussions about genetically modified organisms and about factory farming versus organic farming or locally grown versus the stuff that's made in a lab and hydroponics and all of that? Is it more the merrier, or is there a problem with one mode of production overtaking everything else?
I think you've got to have a number of levels. I think we've now got cities of 20 million people. They cannot be fed on local small-scale production. You can just work out the number of acres it has to be, you know, unless we're all prepared to go back to treading the earth with our feet, and there's no sign that we are. We've got to have large-scale production. Calling it industrial agriculture is a kind of slur. We don't talk about industrial iPods or industrial jet planes, which we're happy with. And it's the same with agriculture. You've got to do it on a large scale. On the other hand, it does seem to me that, for all kinds of reasons, to give variety, to give opportunity to newcomers coming in, to serve as incubators, having some portion of the production being small scale and experimental is a very healthy thing to do. So that's just on a large scale, small scale.
Right. Were you in Hawaii when they were, and I guess they've been doing this for a long time, where they've debated whether or not to allow genetically modified organisms. And they've also had whole crops that get wiped out, if it's a monoculture or a single type of product, that it gets wiped out. So I guess diversity in nature is kind of, I mean, obviously it serves certain evolutionary kinds of functions.
Hawaii is a complex place. It's the only place in the United States, really, where you've got fully tropical conditions for growing. So it's an ideal place to do experimental work. There is a, for political reasons, there's a huge divide in Hawaii between the bulk of the population who are former plantation workers who tend to be sympathetic to GMO because many of them, when they came off the plantations, went into small farming with things like papaya, and GMO rescued the papaya industry, and we eat GMO papayas. Versus people from the mainland and some activists who are very anti-GMO. I tend to be with the former group. I do not see GMO as an enormous threat. I think it's something to another. I don't think it will by itself save the world, but we need all the tools in our toolkit we can get, and it's one of them.
You in various places have written. I find it both haunting and incredibly moving about your mother's experience as your family's cook. And when you talk about tools, your mother, who I believe w was born in what the early 1900s, 19-teens, something like that. That she never really served a meal or cooked a meal for fewer than seven people, but she didn't have a lot. She didn't have a mix master. She didn't have pre-cut vegetables. She didn't have an ability to just walk to the store and get some, prepared food. Talk a little bit about the sheer amount of work that went into your mother's daily efforts and. How do we in the world, particularly those of us in the developed economies of the world, how do we do pay homage and respect to the everyday drudge work in a lot of ways that that our parents and grandparents offered up to us with with just as a part of being alive?
I think I'd like to start by saying my mother was in no way exceptional. That really, up through World War II, this was the fate of usually women, and even in advanced industrial societies like England and the United States, most of Europe. And it still is the way most women in the world work today. One of the greatest benefits for me of the industrialization of food processing has been that I have the privilege that my mother never had of having the opportunity to live life as an academic, as a writer. She would have loved to do things like that. It just wasn't even a possibility unless you came from an enormously wealthy family and could employ a cook. So I think the way we pay homage is to realize that it was the industrialization of food processing that gave us the opportunity that we should not be suggesting that everybody go back to home cooking because it does limit opportunities. If you want to do it, terrific. But you don't, it shouldn't be something that is required if we can arrange society in other ways.
I am reminded both by my preparation for this interview, but also various things that you've said today about how food changes boundaries, food cross it transgresses boundaries with very little I get well, obviously with very little thought in itself, but we mix a lot. We seem to be in a stage that's certainly true in Europe, and it seems to be true in North America. Maybe other parts of the country, increasing nativism in the United States. People are talking about we're entering a new age of isolationism. Our, president-elect doesn't, he wants to end free trade. He wants to end immigrants coming here. America first. In all of this, and in reading your stuff, I was reminded of two anecdotes involving my paternal grandparents, who were both immigrants from Ireland in the mid-1910s to the United States. And they were kind of my grandmother was actually a professional cook. She would she didn't serve many meals for her own kids growing up, but because she was cooking in the kitchen of wealthy families in New York. But she threw up by, a legend in the family. The first time she saw a pizza pie, she threw up because it seemed so disgusting that anybody would eat that. My grandfather would always make the tired joke that you'll never see a cat outside of a Chinese restaurant, implying, of course, that the Chinese just use that as their meat. What is the role that food can play in keeping, in kind of like opening up dialogue and a kind of, a good hybridization, a good mongrelization, a good flow, ebb and flow of different cultures and different types of people getting along together?
Well, let me start by saying, I don't think your grandparents were unusual. It's the natural stance to be suspicious of other people's food. Food is dangerous stuff. You don't know what other people have done to it. You believe that if you eat their food, you will be like them, and if they're not somebody you want to be like. And my family still held the view that you should not eat raw vegetables because that would make you more animal-like. So
so it goes back to that cooking is what makes us human, right?
It's human, and it's our and there's a strong dietary tradition that your own cooking that you have grown up with is the most healthful for you. There may be some biological underpinning to this because, when you move around from one place to another, what's often thought of as Montezuma's revenge may be that your gut flora is not adjusted to, foods from a different place. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we welcome new foreign foods is something that really only came in the mid-20th century. Welcome them. Obviously, we'd always tried them out. We've talked about that before, but that we would incorporate them into our personal meal plans is very much associated, I think, with the cosmopolitanism and belief that we should be open to other peoples that has sort of dominated the political scene for the last 50 years or so. There's also the problem of making a fool of yourself when you eat foreign food. I can't remember which president it was, but was it Ford who tried to eat a tamale and didn't realize you had to take the corn husks off?
Right, yeah. I can't remember now if it was Ford or one of the Bushes or Bob Dole, yeah. But yeah, that's...
So, there's all kinds of reasons why people are hesitant. On the other hand, at the same time, there's this old tradition that hospitality that is involved with food, that eating other people's food is a sign of trust between the host and the guest, that it is what quicker way to learn something about a foreign culture than to enjoy its food. And that's been very much the dominant message for the last 50 years. I hope it continues. I think it will. I think it's very deeply rooted.
Are there any foods that you won't eat, either because of past experience or out of principle?
Not out of principle, I don't think. I don't eat, for all my defense of it, hamburgers. I don't like them. That's not a matter of principle. I don't like some offal. I've never warmed up part, but most other offal I will eat. I'm pretty on for. No, I don't have. Oh, and I don't eat organic food.
You refuse to eat organic food. Is that out of principle, or it must be because you wouldn't know if it's.
Obviously, if somebody offered me organic food, I wouldn't refuse it. I don't buy organic food. I think. Out of principle, I think it's not the way it's been set up. It's not fulfilling the promises that people wanted it to fulfill, and I think it's the wrong way for agriculture to go.
So is that, when you say the promises, do you mean that it's unsustainable at a high volume, or that people think it is more nutritious or somehow more morally pure than a factory-raised carrot? And I say that with ironic air marks.
Yeah. There are levels to this, but that's the main level. I don't think it is either more sustainable or more nutritious or more healthy or tastier. And it was set up very much in an effort to overthrow quote-unquote industrial agriculture. And as I've already said, I think we have no option but large-scale agriculture.
Yeah, there is that horrible letter from Heidegger or essay after World War II where he compares concentration camps to industrial farming. And he's trying to make a point, not how bad, because he was a Nazi, the concentration camps weren't so bad, but industrial farming was bad. It's it haunts me still. You know, do you ever get sick? Obviously, one of the things you're getting at, too, with organics is that people use food as they use different types of etiquette and different, you know, different fabrics and different kinds of sumptuary laws as a way to separate themselves from the masses. Mm-hmm. And so somebody like Michael Pollan, who has done a lot to, you know, kind of intensify interest in food, you know, first it's, oh, you should eat organic. And then it's got to be, well, it's got to be organic that's locally grown. Then it's got to, and it seems like there's this attempt by foodie culture, even as it is fun and exciting and it enriches our lives, they're always trying to separate themselves out from the herd. They're always trying to be onto the next cool thing. Is that part of what you're talking about here that turns you off about organics?
That's part of it, yes. And part of it is just simply that as a farmer's daughter, I believe that fields, you know, really do need fertilizers and crops and pesticides. And, you know, organic has to use those too, but it doesn't always allow itself the ability to avail itself of all the options. And the artificial or synthetic natural divide is it is very dubious.
Yeah. Oh, that's the great deconstruction, that a project that continues, right? The artificial and natural, they're not even two sides of the same coin. It's just a completely interpenetrated dynamic, I think. Do you ever, and I'll end with this, do you ever just get sick of food and of good food and of, you know, everybody now, and I suspect that you travel in circles where everybody expects you to be a good cook, where everybody's asking you whenever you go to somebody's house, oh, you know, isn't this delicious? And I made, you know, is it just enough already and you just want to go sit in the corner with a bowl of rice or a piece of bread or something like that and just be left alone about food for a while?
Yes, I do have that feeling very often. I am actually a reasonably good cook, but I've had a wonderful time during my life experimenting with different foods, but at the moment I'm drawing back and just sticking with my own rather limited choice of foods. It's partly just decision fatigue. It's partly also, though, that the upside of all this experimentation, both with foreign foods and with new techniques that are coming out as the science of food is being unraveled, is that nobody stays with any food long enough to learn how to really discriminate it. And for me, I mean, if you really want to learn to taste what a good bread or cheese or something is, you can't be moving from one to the next every single day. So I think for reasons also of not just decision fatigue, but of a sense of enjoyment. Sometimes simpler is better.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We have been talking to Rachel Loudon. She is the author most recently of Cuisine and Empire, Cooking and World History. Rachel, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts about food, empire, cuisine, and organics with Reason.
Well, thank you for having me, Nick. I enjoyed it.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Subscribe to us at iTunes, rate and review us, and let us know what you think about what we're doing. For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.